Today, Extinction Rebellion struggled to regain last year's momentum.
I first heard about Extinction Rebellion when I was in uni, actually. It was my first year. I went through a couple months of just, not really liking uni, to be honest. I had depression at the time. And then my friend just kind of wanted to get me out of the house. So my friend was like, oh yeah, I went to their protest in November and, you know, I want to go to one of their meetings. And yeah, it really changed my life.
Dei Zagaji was still a teenager when she attended her first Extinction Rebellion meeting. When she arrived, she wasn't even sure she was brave enough to go inside.
We actually waited outside for ages because we were so anxious and we were literally talking ourselves into going to the pub instead. And then someone came and was like, oh, you guys looking for Extinction Rebellion? And we were like, yeah, like really almost like nervous, like, oh God, we've been caught. And then she was like, oh, come on in, I'll make you a cup of tea. And she was so lovely. At the time, it kind of looked a bit like a squat in an office building because it was like the usual, you know, like glass rooms. But then it had like loads of like chalk spray paint of like extinction symbols.
When you started going to these meetings, did you feel right away that you were going to have a voice in this organization?
Yeah, I remember because I think it was just the way it organized itself as well, where it wanted everyone to have the space to speak. So they were like, yeah, great days. Thank you for introducing us to this. Oh, thank you for bringing that. And it did get to the point where it was like, whoa, like I'm not saying anything groundbreaking. But yeah, I did really feel heard. Probably for the first time like that.
In the last 2 years, the organization has grown dramatically and made a name for itself around the world. But it's also had some major stumbles and missteps. Now, in the midst of the chaos of a global pandemic and a massive reckoning on race, the group is struggling to maintain momentum. But the climate crisis is as real as ever. From The Guardian, I'm Mythili Rao. Today in Focus, can Extinction Rebellion capture the public imagination again? In April of 2019, Extinction Rebellion set out to hold what would be their biggest protest yet. Dei was there, as part of the youth contingent, in central London.
I was out on the streets for like the first days of April Rebellion, because at that point, a lot of the XR youth was working towards the Piccadilly site, the site that we were holding as young people. And I remember when we got to Hyde Park, there wasn't that many people. And I was helping keep the banner straight at the front of the march as we were going down to Piccadilly Circus. And it was like almost like by the time we got to Piccadilly Circus, there was a ton of us. A ton of like ferocious young people who are like angry at the system, and it was just so amazing. And the energy, it was kind of one of those like, we're doing this, you know, like we're doing this, this is really happening.
Extinction Rebellion held 5 sites across the city for 10 days.
Shell are morally bankrupt.
Over 1,000 people were arrested.
Circus, the police are using bolt cutters, angle grinders, and special chemicals to break through the glue the protesters have used to stick themselves together.
I think that they were probably the most audacious or ambitious protests, certainly we've seen in the UK for a generation or more.
Matthew Taylor is The Guardian's environment correspondent. He's been following Extinction Rebellion from the start.
The idea of bringing a capital city to a standstill for days on end was quite something. When I first heard about it, I was pretty sceptical that would happen. In doing that, they galvanised the wider environment movement and indeed people who weren't officially part of the environment movement but had a growing sense of unease about where we're heading. They gave confidence to those people that there was something that could be done, that this wasn't something completely out of their control. And if you look at any of the polling before and immediately after that period, they changed how people perceive the climate crisis, certainly in the UK. By the end of the period, there was, you know, people from XR were sitting down with senior politicians from all the main parties.
Today, Mr. Speaker, this House must declare an environment and climate emergency. We have no time to waste.
Parliament declared a climate emergency. There were scores of councils around the country that declared a climate emergency. I mean, I remember going to a meeting at City Hall in London on the banks of the River Thames a couple of days afterwards, which was about how London was unprepared for the coming climate crisis in terms of flooding and extreme heat. And these were people who had spent the last 10 or 15 years that are experts in the field, academia and policymakers and campaigners. And every single one of them stood up and said, almost, I just want to thank XR before we go any further, because it almost felt like the burden that these people have been carrying around individually themselves with this huge knowledge about the sort of calamity that's coming had suddenly been put out in the open to public debate. And there was a sense of relief that this had been put out there.
What were the founding principles of XR?
Well, the three demands of the organisation, which is something slightly different, I guess, is to tell the truth, for the government to tell the truth about the climate crisis, to halt biodiversity loss and reduce emissions to zero by 2025, and for policy to be dictated by a citizens' assembly. So those are the demands. The principles, I guess, were absolutely explicitly non-violent, that direct action by a relatively small group of people could bring about meaningful change quite rapidly. It set out to challenge the system rather than individuals within the system, so they're quite keen not to name and shame individuals.
And why was the timing of their launch so effective?
Well, I think immediately before the build-up to the April rebellion, we'd had increasingly stark warnings from scientists, epitomised really by the IPCC report in the autumn of the year before.
Limiting warming to 1.5 degrees is not impossible, but will require unprecedented transitions in all aspects of society.
Which effectively said, in unusually stark terms, that we have 12 years to avoid the worst impacts of the ecological and environmental crisis. And that, you know, giving people a deadline like that really hit home. I think that was a really big moment. I think for more and more people, was actually becoming a lived reality. Obviously, in other places around the world, that had been going on for some considerable time. But I think in the UK, it was starting to hit home, actually, this is happening. This is not something we're talking about that may or may not happen in the future. We are now living it.
So April was a real high for the group. What happened next?
After April, it had been a huge success. You know, it surprised many people within the organisation how successful it had been. And there was an influx of people and volunteers and money. But with that came an influx of people who had different experiences, different backgrounds, had different ideas about what XR should be and indeed how you achieve the change that's needed. There were increasing discussions and heated discussions and divisions about what next for XR, what was the best way forward. There was one group of people who wanted to push on, escalate the disruption and, you know, drive forward, put pressure on the authorities and the government. There was a second group who were wary of that and think they might lose some of the goodwill generated in April and public support and wanted to take time to take stock of where they were and to build the movement and to build up alliances with other movements and make it reach out internationally, because at this stage it was still very much a UK-based group.
And how did the tension between those two factions express itself?
I think there were tensions and stressful discussions. This sort of culminated, I think, around a discussion about whether or not to try and close down Heathrow Airport by flying drones nearby. And this really took a lot of energy and impetus out of the movement over that summer.
What exactly was the proposed plan with closing down Heathrow? What did they want to do and what was it supposed to achieve?
The act of flying drones meant that Heathrow would be required to, by its own rules, close down the airport. And so they thought that if they had enough people at different places flying drones and then they'd be arrested and someone else would come along and fly a drone somewhere different, they could close the airport down on successive days, bringing chaos to international airlines and services, big hit to the British economy, big loss of public face to the government. The government wouldn't be able to allow this to continue, and so the government would have to again meet with XR, and discussions could go on about their three demands.
The faction of Extinction Rebellion members who thought this wasn't a good idea included XR Youth, which Days was now heavily involved with.
We did not see the purpose of doing Heathrow and in the way the action was designed. The way that, you know, I've experienced civil disobedience in XR was always about using our bodies, you know, and it's always about us saying we are going to put ourselves in harm's way instead of creating fear around other people being put in harm's way. And at least for me, that was the kind of things that I had to debate with when it came to the Heathrow plans. That was the discomfort that I felt.
How do they decide which way to go? I mean, is it really a leaderless organization? I mean, do people vote? Do they just all have to agree like a jury?
So XR is organized along a decentralized model line. So that means that there is no formal leaders or formal heads, but there are circles, they call them. So these are groups of 12 or more people that have responsibility in different areas like legal support or planning actions or media and messaging. And they work out what's happening in those areas, and then they send people back to report centrally to the central committee that works out the overall direction of the organization. In the end, there was an intervention by XR Youth where they occupied one of these key strategy meetings and expressed their unhappiness with the plans for Heathrow and their unhappiness with their position within the organization.
This was not just a disagreement. It was a small crisis about what the organization's mission was really about. Daze decided she had to do something. Can you tell me the story of the cinnamon roll intervention?
The cinnamon roll intervention? Oh my God, that's great. So we were holding XR Youth Weekend and we were sat there and we were talking about Heathrow and how it didn't make sense to a lot of us, and a lot of us felt a lot of discomfort around the plans. So then we actually decided that we were going to go to the strategy meeting because we felt like we weren't being heard. So we decided to go from Bristol to Stroud, where they were having the meeting. And we came with cinnamon rolls, which we put icing on it, saying we love you to the people that we were about to disrupt their meeting.
When you got there, what was the reaction?
I think it was a bit of confusion when we came in, because it was like we weren't actually meant to be there. And it was kind of like, oh, what are you guys doing here? Because obviously, like, if you're going to Stroud, it's quite purposeful if you managed to get there. But I think when one of the members of XR Youth did a speech about how we don't agree with Heathrow and why we don't agree with Heathrow and why we should be listened to, the atmosphere was tense, but also loving, but also teary, and everyone just had that moment of catharsis of, you know, asking yourself, you know, like, am I getting this wrong?
Matthew, this was clearly a very sensitive issue for everyone involved. What did the group decide?
In the end, XR essentially decided not to go ahead with Heathrow. However, the people who were keen on doing it set up a different organization called Heathrow Pause and did it under that banner. Formerly, that wasn't XR, although there were quite a few XR people involved in it.
So within the span of just a few months, Extinction Rebellion went from holding its most successful protests ever to managing an internal crisis and rebellion from its youth wing, and seeing the creation of a splinter group. One of the founding members, Roger Hallam, stepped back from his role. But as last summer came to an end, the group still had a hunger for more high-profile action. Matthew, how did the October protests go?
Well, I think these are broadly seen as to have not been as successful as April, and I think that's right. There were various factors involved in that. The weather was pretty bad, it was dark, police tactics were much harsher, and they were pretty keen to close things down more quickly this time. And of course, fundamentally, the novelty element had gone. People were no longer as surprised that XR were doing this as they had been in April, and that includes journalists as well as the public. I think that they made some tactical missteps in terms of they tried to shut down a tube line in East London, and instead of disrupting bankers or city finances on their way to work, they got it wrong and they were, you know, there's a video of them disrupting people on the way to sort of cleaning and building jobs, and the imagery of that was really problematic for them, I think. It ended up in a scuffle with people pulling some of the protests off the top of the train.
They're doing it the wrong way. They're doing it for the right reasons, but they're doing it the wrong way.
I think they've really shot themselves in the foot, to be fair. A lot of people getting public transport as opposed to getting their own transport.
In the morning, my mum called me And she was like, what's going on? I hope you're not there. And I was like, where? Then she sent me the video and I was like, oh God, oh God. it wasn't our, like, you know, brightest moment. I've put my hands up on that. But I do think that we've learned so many lessons from Canning Town and the actions that went there. And I do think that it is one of those things where, like, we are at, you know, as I talked about, like, we didn't expect this to be so successful. We didn't expect this to grow so quickly. And I feel like we were so naive and still needing maturing at that time. And that action was almost like an embodiment of that.
At the start of this year, what was XR planning?
At the start of this year, we were planning on how to move into a next phase. So after Rebellion, we went into, you know, a little, you know, natural cycle of hibernation to do some reflecting and some learning and gather feedback about what we need to improve, what we can do better. So we actually started planning towards a Rebellion, which I think was meant to be taking place in May. But then COVID happened.
Was it strange to see the economy shut down overnight and to just see all these things that XR has talked about, like eliminating air travel, cutting back on consumption, suddenly become normal, even if just for this particular span of time?
Yeah, I think that because, like, XR is always focused on, like, you know, the need for systemic change, and seeing that systemic change happening where the government was like, okay, right, we've actually got an issue on our hands and we're going to have to sort it out. It made people think, why did they not do this earlier? Why have they not done this with other social justice issues that are important as well? It really made us question. And also, like, it really ripped away the lines of what's impossible.
Matthew, when the coronavirus hit, it was suddenly all anyone was talking about, all anyone was thinking about. We definitely weren't really talking about the environment anymore. Was this a strange moment for you as an environmental reporter?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a strange moment for all of us for all sorts of reasons, wasn't it? But I think from an environmental point of view, I think it's been a really interesting time. I think the climate crisis has never been treated remotely as seriously as the coronavirus crisis has been treated in the last few months. And I think there is frustration within the climate movement around that actually it's possible. If you mobilize the resources of the state, then really drastic measures are possible. We look around the world, there's $1 trillion stimulus packages being drafted now. What the climate movement is crying out for is for the climate crisis, which will cause arguably much more devastation and problems if it continues to escalate than even the coronavirus crisis has, needs to be treated as a crisis, as an emergency.
And anecdotally, a lot of people have talked about noticing how much cleaner the air has been without so many cars on the street. How much have global emissions gone down in lockdown?
There was a study recently that showed that in more than 100 countries looked at, there was a 25% reduction in emissions during April, but it is only a blip, I think. If we continue on the current trajectory of the economic shutdown and then slowly rebuilding back up again, I think they think it might be a tiny decrease in temperature of 0.01% something by 2030. So I suppose the material impact of the shutdown is minimal, but the space it has given us to sort of consider who we are and what we want to be, and the necessity it is forcing on us to invest and restructure, because we'll have to do that, seems to me to be a really significant opportunity.
It's an opportunity, but are politicians taking it, and are voters really thinking about it?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, we've got the world's sort of leading climate scientists saying we absolutely have to do this. At the same time, you've got polling showing that environmental concerns and concerns about sustainable, reliable, well-paid jobs into the future are growing amongst the population. But at the moment, the stumbling block is national governments.
We haven't talked yet about the other big event that's dominated the last few months, the Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm.
Did those protests and that movement change the way Extinction Rebellion saw its own movement?
Yeah, I think it highlighted a really serious critique of Extinction Rebellion that's been from pretty much the start from Black and ethnic minority groups. Basically, Extinction Rebellion, one of its main aims was to get loads of people arrested, because the idea was you get loads of people arrested, you overwhelm the system, you block up the court system, you block up the police cells, police tell the government we can't do this anymore, and then the government are forced to come and talk to you know, the protesters, and then they get in the room and they discuss their demands.
And in some ways, that's like classic civil disobedience, right?
It's absolutely classic civil disobedience. But what angered and frustrated many non-white activists, climate activists and black groups, certainly in the UK, was that this tactic was alienating to all but, you know, fairly privileged white people. And I think that has been a building critique of XR. But I think the explosions of protests around Black Lives Matter and the killing of George Floyd really brought that home.
Days, when you joined XR, as a black person, were you concerned about the arrest tactics? Did you see that as a barrier or something that made you uncomfortable?
I think for me, like, I did grapple with that, you know, to be arrested or not to be arrested kind of question. But I feel like there was so much information around making your own choice that you don't actually have to be arrested to be a part of this movement.
Were you worried it could be a barrier for entry for other black youth?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Especially like when it comes to my upbringing, like I partly grew up in Lincolnshire, and that was, you know, like I do have a very, you know, white passing like voice. So I do know that that's actually gotten me out of trouble before of where they've tried to stop and search me. And because I spoke, they were like, no, don't worry, love. It's OK. So I knew that it was not the same for other black youth.
Did you go to any Black Lives Matter protests?
Yes, I did.
Did it feel different from the XR actions? Did it have the same kind of energy?
Yeah, I feel like it did, but it also didn't. Like, I, you know, like the joy that protest brings, you know, and this like resilience and showing of resilience brings. I feel like I had it at the Black Lives Matter protest as well. But also there was this kind of anxiety around the police. And I feel like the police were far harder on Black Lives Matter when I was at the protest, especially when it got later on in the day, than they had been to XR.
In July, XR released a statement talking about mistakes the organization had made in the past, particularly with racial inclusivity. Were you happy with that statement?
So this statement basically said how we've got our relationship with the police, how we've got it wrong, and how we have actually embodied some of the issues around white supremacy, and that we apologize for this. And we are learning how to be better about, you know, racial injustice. I was really happy with it, actually. I think it's something that we should have said a long time ago, because I think a lot of us have been feeling this for a little while, but not knowing how to do it. I saw it as like an apology. And, you know, like I saw the way people reacted to it outside of the movement through my friends and my families. But I also saw the way that people reacted within the movement, and especially like the people of color and marginalized communities that have been greatly and disproportionately affected by the police. It felt like something like a changing point, really.
Coming up, where XR goes from here. Matthew, the pandemic has really slowed Extinction Rebellion's activities this year, and it seems like they would need something big to really recapture that momentum they had just a year ago. What is XR planning for the next few months?
The next big thing that they've got planned is for the 1st of September. There's going to be what I've been told will be 2 weeks of protests. So both April and October were broadly 2 weeks, and again, they're trying to go for 2 weeks of civil disobedience. The difference this time is that, as I understand it, they're not going to try and hold sites day after day at the same sites overnight and things. They're going to pop up at site, cause disruption, do the civil disobedience, and then go away, come again another day somewhere else. It's more about targeting specific institutions that they deem as responsible for the inaction on climate. So that would be Parliament as an obvious example, financial institutions, maybe media companies who they don't believe have been reporting this properly. So I think it will feel different. I've been told that there's been a lot of work done to make this not just an XR event. This will be a broader civil disobedience event, bringing in people who are concerned about health inequality in this country, and particularly on the back of the COVID crisis, bringing in Black Lives Matter groups. So that's the idea, that it will be a broader and coming together of different groups.
Can you imagine the organization managing to recapture that sense of momentum and possibility that it created last year? I mean, what would it take to do that?
I think that the underlying facts of the climate crisis are in XR's favour. You know, whatever missteps tactically it makes or whatever mess ups on tube lines it makes, the reality is we have got an escalating climate crisis, and governments are not at the moment responding with the necessary urgency. That reality is only going to come more stark over the months and years ahead. So it may not be XR that leads the fight in a year's time or 8 months' time or 2 months' time. It may be. There may be that we'll look back and think of them. They're the people that changed the game in this. Who knows where XR will be in a year or 18 months, but the reality of what they're saying will not have gone away.
That was Matthew Taylor and Daze Agaji. You can read Matthew's long read on the evolution of Extinction Rebellion at theguardian.com. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Kasson, sound designed by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.